This is the BBC.
Hello, this is Sam Coates from The Times. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Week in Westminster. In this edition, Russia looms large. Amid the gloom, let's begin with a bit of good news. For once, it's a Brexit-free edition of the show. That's because attention has shifted 1,400 miles east from Brussels to Moscow. In the aftermath of the chemical attack in Salisbury, the US, France and Germany joined with the British government to speak with one voice and declare,
"Frankly, Russia should go away, it should shut up."
So said the person the Russians call the vulgar old harpy of the British government. Or, as we know him, Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary. This week, the government set out in the Commons, at the UN and at the North Atlantic Council of NATO why it believes the Russian state is responsible for the poisonings of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury. For his part, Boris Johnson wasted no time at all attacking the Russian response. President Putin's government, he suggested without any irony at all, wanted to have their cake and eat it.
They want to simultaneously to deny it and yet at the same time to glory in it.
Britain and its allies will now embark on an uncertain path with an unclear destination and a very, very tricksy opponent. To work out what happens next, Britain's past entanglements with Russia are as good a guide as any. Tom Fletcher was a senior foreign policy advisor to Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and David Cameron until the end of 2010, before moving to be the British ambassador in Beirut until 2015. He began by talking about his first-hand experience of Russia, including how and why Russia defied the diplomatic odds to host the very World Cup this summer, which some MPs now want us to boycott.
So it's obviously a much less grim example than what we've seen in Salisbury in recent days. But we were out in Zurich basically competing, we thought, within the rules for the World Cup, which is taking place later this year. We won on just about every evaluation. And yet somehow it got to the vote and we discovered that Russia had the votes and we didn't. And what was clear talking to the FIFA delegates afterwards was that they'd come under huge pressure. A lot of people talk about Russia buying that World Cup. A lot of it was actually intimidation. I remember talking to this one delegate and saying, "How did you feel you could lie to us in this way?" And he said, "Well, just imagine if I'd lied to Putin." I think it shows this pattern of threatening behavior, which is often deliberately designed to intimidate other people. And I think that's what we've seen again in Salisbury last week.
What in effect you're saying is that they just have a much greater footprint of influence than perhaps we have recognised. Isn't some of that just successful diplomacy, a big country exercising its influence in the world? Or is it always something more sinister?
Well, I think that this is different to these kind of classic tit-for-tat espionage breakdowns or the usual rules of diplomacy. You know, we saw it again in the summer of 2013 when we were debating as the international community, what do we do about Assad having used chemical weapons, having crossed the red line? And what we found at that time was that Putin's administration was ready to be completely unscrupulous about the way that they manipulated the information, but also played fast and loose with every agreement that was made. And it's a challenge, I think, for a lot of democracies, rightly accountable, transparent in the way they carry out policy, government, diplomacy. What it means, though, is that those countries have almost shown their cards to the other side. And in that case, we were playing poker, really, against Putin about what would happen in Syria. And yeah, he could see our cards.
Could you just spell out, because I think the lessons are extremely valuable and relevant for today, can you spell out what you mean by manipulating information and playing games with processes?
So I think we have to be very alert to the way in which Putin has very successfully manipulated news and the internet in order to create this fog of distrust, to create this sense that you can't really trust anyone, that no facts are real facts. I think also the way that you see the Russians, and I've experienced this myself on social media, on Twitter, are able to deploy these great armies of trolls to intimidate and harass people who take a different view of the world. It actually has a very chilling effect on social media.
I suppose that the problem that some people have is trying to discern what the goal of Russia is disrupting other countries. What is it that, at the end of the day, they want to get out of the West, out of countries like Britain, out of destabilizing the world order.
So I think we have to separate Russia's goals from Putin's goals. And I think in our response to this crisis, we have to be very careful to focus on Putin's interests rather than Russia more widely. I think primarily it's about survival. To survive, Putin needs to project this sense of force and international intimidation to show people that Russia is strong again. It's very like Donald Trump's Make America Great Again. And if that means destroying a country like Syria, then that's what will happen.
It sounds to me from that explanation that so long as President Putin is in the Kremlin, we can never win this one.
In my experience, every few years, and it's a product of our democratic cycle, someone comes along and says, it's terrible what Putin has done, but maybe it's time for a reset. And I think Putin basically waits for those moments, and several of them have come round. And I think we have to be very careful the next time that conversation comes along, that we look at what Russia has done now over a long period of time in a very rational way and assess that whole record and not go into it starry-eyed that suddenly he's going to have this great change of heart and change of plan.
Tom Fletcher on President Putin, Russia and misinformation. So how does Britain's response now compare with the past, and what should Theresa May do next? Sir Malcolm Rifkind is former Foreign Secretary under John Major, kingpin of King Charles Street from 1995 to 1997. He also served as chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee from 2010 to 2015. He's both friends with Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union before its breakup in 1989, but is now banned from Russia. President Putin decided last year that his support for sanctions over Russian action in Crimea disqualified him from entry. I began by asking how this current crisis compared to those of the past.
I think there are two major distinctions. In the past, the expulsion of what were then Soviet diplomats were essentially because either they had been involved in espionage or it was a reaction against some aspect of Soviet foreign policy, like the invasion of Afghanistan. What we're dealing with now is different in two respects. First of all, this was because of the attempted murder of two people, one a British citizen, the other a Russian citizen, his daughter. And secondly, of course, it's happening at a time when we're not in the Cold War, despite the term occasionally being used. But this wasn't because of our international relations with Russia. This was because of Russian antagonism against the individual they seem to have been trying to kill.
So you would say this episode was more serious than what happened under Ted Heath and under Margaret Thatcher?
I think when it's a difference of foreign policy or espionage activity, then that can be seen as something which is self-contained. But, you know, after the Litvinenko affair, no civilized government would behave like this, and no civilized government would react other than very harshly if they were subject to the murder of people on their own streets by a foreign state.
You've heard Theresa May outline this week a package of retaliatory measures. How do you think that the response compares to what we've done in the past? Is it tough enough?
Oh, it comes at the hard end of the spectrum, because the 23 people who are being expelled represents 40%, almost half, the staff of the Russian embassy in London. Now, on previous occasions during the Cold War, the then Soviet embassy was a much, much larger embassy. So although the numbers of people expelled were more, as a percentage of the total, it was actually considerably less. This is very, very serious. And, of course, what it has done, we should not underestimate the long-term damage it has done to Russian intelligence operations. If you are eliminating, as the Prime Minister's decision indicates, pretty well all the intelligence people in the embassy, it will take them at least a generation to recover from that, because if they try to just simply appoint new people, the Prime Minister already made it clear we will not accept them if they have an intelligence background.
But why expel 40%? Why not expel 100%?
Well, it has to be clear that the government has the option of increasing the number very considerably if that becomes appropriate. But in any event, I don't think we're talking about ending all contact between Russia and the United Kingdom. It may come to that. But there are good reasons why you don't break off diplomatic relations in the entirety unless you are about to go into something even more ghastly, military conflict.
Sir Malcolm Rifkind on how to send a message to Moscow. On Wednesday, Theresa May outlined Britain's response to Russia. In the Commons debate that followed, there was nearly a consensus over Britain's response. But there is quite a bitter, personal disagreement between the Labour and Tory front benches and between allies of Jeremy Corbyn and others in the Labour Parliamentary Party over what we do and don't know and what should happen next. Can the two sides be reconciled? Representing the two poles of the debate, I consulted Tom Tugendhat, the Tory chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and Chris Williamson, Labour MP and ally of the Labour leader. I started by asking Tom why he was pointing the finger at the Russian state when he wasn't privy to the government's intelligence.
Well, we can be very sure that the Kremlin is behind it. And the reason I can be so sure is because in my former career as an intelligence officer in the army, I worked with the people who are doing the current investigation. So I know what they're looking for and I know what they're looking at. They will have found traces of chemical, which they will have run studies on, which they will have linked to other chemical finds they will have secured from various different means, and they will have compared them. They will therefore have a signature on the chemical, which identifies not only what kind of nerve agent it is, but also the laboratory that made it. And because chemicals degrade with age, they will also have a rough idea as to when it was produced. And they may even, if they've got that level of accuracy, I don't know whether they have achieved it in this one, know the batch and the person who made it.
But, Tom, there are people who say and admit that there are rogue elements, even within the Russian intelligence services. How can we be sure that it was President Putin and the Kremlin that gave an order rather than some kind of factionalism within Moscow, within the Kremlin, that is responsible?
It's absolutely true that there are rogue elements. It is possible, but it is extremely unlikely, that the Kremlin has lost control of one of its chemical weapon stores or its nerve agent stores. And that was the question that the Prime Minister was asking on Monday, whether or not the Kremlin was going to admit that actually they had lost control. But it seems incredibly unlikely they would have allowed one of the most potent weapons they have to fall into hands that are not under their control.
Chris, we've heard this week different Labour MPs saying they believe different things. Where do you stand at the moment?
Well, I think Tom's just conceded there that he's not absolutely certain that the Kremlin are responsible for this. I think he suggested that the evidence points towards the Kremlin, and that's true. I think our position is that it points towards the Kremlin or a rogue element, as you point out. And I think it's worth remembering that the old Soviet Union was comprised of a number of different countries, all of which will have had their own KGB operatives, many if not all of whom may have had access to these nerve agents. And I therefore think it's reasonable to ask for the evidence to be produced before we start raising international tensions. We need to be measured. And this is why Jeremy's contribution was so statesmanlike, because he was approaching it with a cool head. And let's also remember, you know, we've had a united front in the House of Commons in the past. We've listened to intelligence reports, unimpeachable intelligence reports that said that Saddam Hussein, for example, had weapons of mass destruction which could be deployed within 15 minutes. We heard the same about the importance of, you know, taking on Gaddafi. And what we did, we blew up a country and then walked away.
Tom, it remains, after the Iraq War, a fact that not everybody trusts the intelligence services.
Of course that's true, and that's why it's so important to look not just at the single incident, but to look at a pattern. This attack comes as part of a pattern, including the attempted poisoning of the Montenegrin Prime Minister, the Litvinenko attack in 2006, the attacks on various Estonian and Ukrainians, including one of the candidates for the Ukrainian presidential election. We have seen Russian use of poisoning time and time again.
If I could summarise both of your positions, it sounds to me that Chris is more worried about the negative consequences of taking action, and Tom is more worried about the negative consequences of not taking action. So what do you think the dangers are, Chris, of acting precipitously?
A number of dangers. The very real danger and worry, in my view, of this escalating out of control, we end up in a hot war, which would be absolutely disastrous. And I hope Tom doesn't want that. But listening to the bellicose rhetoric of the Tories in the House, it seemed that a number of them would be more than happy to do that. And indeed, when Jeremy was speaking, one of them got a white handkerchief out, was waving it as if we were capitulating, we're appeasers. But of course, the other thing is things like our energy security. You know, half of our liquefied gas, for example, came from Russia this year so far. So, you know, we need to be taking all of these things into account. It seems to me. And I think as well, I would hope that the Conservatives will be less squeamish about taking action to stop money laundering activities. In the past, when we've sought to bring those measures in, we put forward a proposition, it's been voted down by the Conservatives. But of course, we know that the Conservatives, to a large extent, are bankrolled by Russian oligarchs.
Tom, you think the danger is if we don't take action, where, if you pursued Chris's course, do you worry that we end up?
So the problem with what Jeremy said in the Commons the other day wasn't that he was offering a measured approach, is that he was repeating the propaganda from the Kremlin. And that's why people got rather disappointed about it. And what the danger is here is that we've seen a regime that over 20 years has robbed and murdered its own people. It has butchered journalists. It has executed civic activists and opponents to the president time and time again. And we're seeing a new Tsarist regime, a new brutal autocracy surrounded by an aristocracy of oligarchs. And what is extraordinary is we're seeing those who should be standing up for the weak actually defending the butchers. And
that's very unfair, Tom. We've spoken out against the human rights record of Putin, and indeed we've called for measures to tackle the oligarchs and money laundering and the rest of it.
And your party opposed it.
Well, it is true.
No, it's not true.
Jeremy has particularly stood out against human rights abuses in Russia. Now, come on, you know that's true, Tom. So please don't misrepresent the situation.
I'm afraid it's not true, Chris. And you can read it.
Flying in the face of the record.
You can read it in the articles written by his chief of staff in The Guardian in the past 10 years. You can read it in the articles that he has written in the past 30 years, where he has consistently backed demagogues and dictators.
And he has consistently backed death squads, not the human rights activists. I can't believe Tom is even saying such a thing, but there we are.
Chris, should it be proved to your satisfaction that the Russian state was responsible, what would be a proportionate response?
Well, I mean, I think the measures that the Prime Minister has taken would be a proportionate response. But of course, what we have to do, though, is then decide where do we go from there? And I'm fearful that, you know, these things could escalate out of control. And we need to have an eye on the end game. And I'm not sure that the government has got an end game.
Russia has invaded two of its neighbours. It's shot down a civilian aircraft. It's launched a cyber attack on the Estonian economy, kidnapped plenty of people in Ukraine and still occupies Georgia. It's kidnapped a border guard in Estonia. And even now it's backing the Assad regime as it gasses and murders its own people. What more are you concerned about that they might do?
Well, I'm not so much concerned about what they might do. It's about where we go and what the implication is for Britain.
So you don't think we should stand up to them?
Well, yes, but, you know, we should have been standing up to them and standing up to them in terms of their human rights record long ago.
Chris Williamson and Tom Tugendhat explaining their differences. There was another big shift in British politics this week. On Tuesday, Chancellor Philip Hammond signalled that he was prepared to ease off austerity and spend more in the run-up to the next election on public services.
If there are any Eeyores in the chamber, they're over there. I, meanwhile, am at my most positively Tigger-like today as I contemplate a country which faces the future with unique strengths.
Now, both parties will hate me for saying so, but this does suggest that there is a new consensus, a new paradigm on economic policy, with the two sides differing only on the degree of spending required in future rather than the overall direction. To discuss how this has shifted the political kaleidoscope, I was joined by Labour's Stephen Timms, who was in the Treasury under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and the Conservative Bim Afolami, one of the stars of the 2017 intake. I asked Bim if he was one of those who now wanted to spend more on public services after 8 years of austerity.
Actually, I do think that we do need to spend more on public services over the next few years, but I think that spending needs to be balanced off against making sure that we manage the debt position we don't want to get out of control.
Do you think that this is a settled position in the Conservative Party, or do you think that there's still a bit of debate with some of your colleagues arguing that you should prioritise the deficit more, some of them arguing that you should spend a bit more on public services?
Yes, I think there is a debate. I don't think it's a settled position. I think the way you've characterised it is broadly correct. What I would say is that I'd like to see the government and the party generally talk about raising the potential growth rate of the economy as well, because we keep spending a lot of time talking about the fiscal position. We need to see if we can increase our growth rate in the medium long term, and that will deal with a lot of these problems as well.
Stephen, we heard from Philip Hammond this week that the debt will be going down. He cheered the fact that as a proportion of GDP, that figure is now, in his words, a turning point, and we're going to see that reduce over the rest of the course of that parliament. Is that something in of itself that you think is a good thing?
Well, I think we do, over time, need to make sure that the government's income matches its spending. That's why I welcome so much that in our manifesto last June, we said how much extra we were going to spend, and we said we would need to spend more on public services. We also said where we're going to get the money from in increased taxes. And I think that's the right approach.
But are you fundamentally happy to see a Labour government in the future increase the level of, for instance, debt as a proportion of GDP, if it needs to do so in order to achieve the political and spending goals that it wants to?
If it needs to, I think it should be willing to do so, as governments of both parties have done in the past. And, you know, if you look at the housing crisis, for example, that we're facing at the moment, it seems to me to be very similar to crises in the past where governments like the Macmillan government were willing to spend on investment in housing. The case for that today seems to be just as strong as it was then.
So a glimmer of consensus on the issue of increasing public spending, but I want to know whether you would spend it on the same things. Bim, what would your priorities be?
As a son of a consultant, I'm acutely aware of this. I think the NHS is going to need increased funds over the next few years.
So you put the NHS at the top of your list. Stephen, would you agree with that?
Housing would be right at the top of my list. But I certainly agree with Bim. The NHS does need more funding. It's had a desperate winter and 100,000 unfilled NHS vacancies at the moment. There's a long list, but right at the top of my list would be the housing crisis and the need to invest public money in housing.
Now, I suspect that many Conservatives would tense their muscles at the idea of comparisons, at the overall similarity in direction between Labour and Tory economic policy. And really, the question now is, we want to spend more, but by how much? It's a question of degree. Bim, how are you going to differentiate yourself from the Labour Party when it comes to spending? Because in the end, you're never going to match them. Labour are always going to spend more than you guys, but you are starting to engage in that arms race. Where do you draw the line?
Well, what I'd say is Stephen is from what I call the sensible wing of the Labour Party and takes a very balanced approach to these issues. This is not the same as the Labour Party leadership, which has not advocated sort of reasonable spending increases across the board. It is advocating sort of mass nationalisations costing hundreds of billions of pounds. That is not a consensus position. In relation to your point around, you know, where do you draw the line or do we engage with a sort of arms race with Labour? The question is always a balance between growing the economy, dealing with the deficit and debt position, and investing in public services in the right way, and in particular, invest in the things that help grow the economy. Infrastructure is something that we haven't mentioned, but I think that is also an area that can actually help grow the potential growth rate of the economy, and we need to prioritise those areas of spending as well.
Stephen, you said earlier that you welcomed the Labour manifesto, which broadly found tax rises to pay for additional spending outside of things like nationalisations. But there have been a lot of questions from independent institutes like the Institute for Fiscal Studies saying you're just never going to get the amount of money that you save from, for instance, wealth taxes.
I think there is scope for increasing, for example, income tax on the highest paid. I think that could be done and would generate worthwhile sums. There are other ideas in the Labour manifesto, for example, extending stamp duty reserve tax to derivatives. So, yes, I do think there is a substantial scope, as things stand at the moment, for increasing taxation and funding what needs to be funded.
Stephen Timms and Bim Afolami, with a perhaps unhealthy level of agreement on the economy. This week has felt like the first since, well, June 2016, where Brexit hasn't dominated. The all-encompassing nature of leaving the European Union can occasionally be challenging, even for newspaper readers and radio listeners. There are even the occasional whispers from MPs who say they are bored with the subject. But for companies, charities and other organisations that rely on the government machine for help to sort problems and recognise their challenges, the Brexit behemoth has been a particular challenge. People trying to raise other issues over the last 21 months have found it very hard going. Jan Trigellis is chief executive of MenCap, a charity which helps people with learning disabilities. They've been pleading for help from government over controversial changes to payments for carers who sleep over with the disabled. She joined me with Damian Green, who was pivotal in Theresa May's government until December, first in the work and pensions brief and then in the Cabinet Office. Jan Trigellis first.
If you recognise the seriousness of what it is and how vulnerable people are in peril, and we have not been able to get to a Cabinet Minister to talk this through, We have been speaking to mid-ranking civil servants and junior ministers, but no cabinet ministers wanted to have a conversation. What it's felt like is that the government are deaf to the issue and haven't wanted to talk about it each time we've been palmed off.
And when you talk to civil servants and mid-ranking ministers, do they ever say, look, it's quite hard to get the attention of the people at the top of the tree because of Brexit? Do people who talk to you specifically blame Brexit as one of the reasons why this is hard to get on the agenda?
What we hear is that decisions are very slow and that this is a financial issue, and with the government position on finances, it's difficult to get through. So we hear it as a financial issue more than we hear it as any other issue.
Damien, do you recognise that as a characterisation? Can you sympathise with it? Do you understand it? Do you think it's a fair characterisation for other things as well?
I mean, it's absolutely unfair to say that, that ministers are deaf to this. And you know, I know very personally, I used to chair meetings about it at which you know, cabinet ministers were present. So ministers at all levels of government are extremely aware of it. It is indeed true. It's a financial issue. This has been a long process, but it's not actually to do with government capacity. I think it is just one of those decisions that is very difficult to get to.
So you don't think that if it was related to Brexit, it would be higher up the agenda, either of you?
I think without Brexit, I think it would have been resolved. I think the time it's taken has been so extended, and I think we would have had much more proactive oversight of it to fast-track it. You know, I think the government was caught out last year when this came to be an issue, and I think they have been slow to respond.
I think it's unfair to say that the government is in some way neglecting the domestic agenda because of Brexit, but the government absolutely does have to and is doing certain things to cope with the extra demands of the Brexit process. I mean, thousands of extra civil servants have been employed after years of cutting the numbers of civil servants. So, if you like, the bandwidth of Whitehall has been increased, precisely so that the very important job of pursuing the Prime Minister's domestic agenda can go side by side with these hugely important Brexit negotiations.
So for people like Jan, for companies, for charities, for other associations, what would your message to them be? Essentially, don't give up. We are listening, even if we don't always look like we are.
Absolutely. There are often frustrations between government and NGOs and charities and indeed businesses. But I'm confident, I can see, and I've seen for myself, I'm inside the machine, that the day-to-day business of government is going on.
Tory MP Damien Green and Jan Tregellis of MenCap on the difficulties of getting things done. Now, if you're having Brexit withdrawal symptoms, fear not. Next week, the EU27 will meet with Theresa May and agree the terms of the UK's transition deal. Or maybe they won't. But if we could celebrate one union which will endure, it is the one struck on the floor of the House of Commons. Matthew Revel, a civil servant, asked Rachel Evans, a Labour researcher, to marry him on a tour of Parliament when MPs were not sitting. Here was her answer. And as we all know, nobody would ever go back on something they said in the Commons. Paul Waugh of the Huffington Post will be here next week. And that's all from me, Sam Coates of the Times. Goodbye.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.